7 of those 15 agencies received a failing grade. Nobody got an A. They struggled. They really did.
Yep, the government is a lousy student when it comes to responding to Freedom of Information requests. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It's been 50 years since the Supreme Court's decision on New York Times versus Sullivan that forever changed the practice of journalism.
You have this very strong ruling that says, listen, there is a place in America for public dissent against public officials. They're not going to be able to use these libel and slander laws as offensive weapons to chill speech.
Trigger warnings, invented to warn readers of potentially traumatic content, are now running amok.
I started to explore this after a woman on an online forum I belong to requested that anything related to pregnancy or birth announcements be labeled with a trigger warning on behalf of infertile women.
There's more coming up after this.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. What became of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370?
Something happened to this 777's ability to report to the ground. Was that because of a massive electrical failure? Was the crew incapacitated because of a lack of oxygen? Or did the crew actually turn off equipment?
Every lead that comes up seems to evaporate.
So many
from terrorism to catastrophic structural failure to alien tractor beams, the theories on a vanishing jetliner have come fast and furious. And one after another, they have themselves disappeared into nothingness. The Iranians with the stolen passports weren't terrorists, but young men seeking political asylum in Europe. The loss of radar contact did not pinpoint a disaster scene. The plane might have been aloft for hours more. The plane leaving Kuala Lumpur carrying baggage of no-show passengers? Simply false. And those phantom phone calls, loved ones dialing passengers and hearing rings followed cruelly by sudden hang-ups? On CNN, tech analyst Jeff Kagan said, please harbor no false hopes.
This is one of the sad parts about the technology. You place the call, you press send. What happens is you start hearing ringing, but the other phone isn't ringing yet. The network has to find the phone, and then they have to send the call there. If it doesn't find the phone after a few minutes, after a few rings, then typically it disconnects, and that's what's happening.
Unlike other breaking news stories wherein a traumatic what, when, and where trigger a mad and often slapdash scavenger hunt for the who and why, this story lacks even the what. It is a mysterious, compelling, terrifying exploration of negative space. Here was Chris Cuomo on CNN.
Often in a situation like the mystery of Malaysian Flight 370, the job is to have more questions than there are answers because simply not enough is known. So if it seems like we're nibbling around the edges, it's because we are.
Yet the search for Flight 370 has not been characterized by the breathless, irresponsible reporting of rumor and speculation that has so infected coverage of Sandy Hook, the Boston Marathon bombings, and other recent tragedies. On the contrary, in the process of reporting what authorities don't know, all that journalistic nibbling around the edges has given the audience an education in technology, geopolitics, conspiracy mentality, and not least, airport security. How not to be thunderstruck, for instance, at the revelation that fewer than 20 of Interpol's 190 member countries cross-check travel documents against the database of stolen passports. NBC's Brian Williams.
Though it appears the two men with those stolen passports on board had nothing to do with this aircraft's disappearance, the fact that they could board the aircraft has now called new attention to a huge lapse in global airline security, even this many years after 9/11.
Equally shocking was the news that modern airliners flying over the ocean, despite GPS and other satellite technology, do not have continuous communications with land. This was CNN's Brian Todd with aviation expert Brian McCabe.
How do you lose an airplane? Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 also had GPS and a transponder sending signals from the cockpit to air traffic control. The jet was tracked by radar. But now that we know the transponder signal was not operational when the plane disappeared.
Yet another nerve-wracking line of inquiry, Chinese expansionism in the South China Sea, specifically the disputed border off the coast of the Malaysian island of Borneo. Saber-rattling over Borneo? Who knew? Naturally, of course, conspiracy theories also abounded. They always abound because, as this episode once again demonstrates, there is no mystery or tragedy too mysterious or tragic to fit snugly in someone's preconceived notions of world events. A hammer thinks everything is a nail, and Reddit user Dark Spectre deduced mass murder by U.S. intelligence operatives, of course, determined to prevent a brain trust of technology executives aboard the flight from deplaning into the hands of the Chinese. But here's the thing. That post was unearthed by one reporter for one Boston news site who made it an object of ridicule. The Ludlam-esque scenario otherwise never passed the lips of a single cable news anchor. How that newfound restraint came to pass may be the biggest mystery of all.
Coming up, for the first time, the government is comprehensively graded on its responses to Freedom of Information Act requests.
And it fails. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. As we previously and exhaustively reported, U.S. Customs and Border Protection, under the aegis of the Department of Homeland Security, is one of the least transparent agencies in the country. But late last week, sparked by a leak of a review done by the Police Executive Research Forum, CBP shone a little light on its processes. Brian Bennett, national security correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune, was the recipient of that initial leaked report.
And they came to conclusions. They came to some pretty damning conclusions that sometimes the Border Patrol had acted out of frustration when they fired at people throwing rocks, and sometimes that Border Patrol had stepped in front of moving vehicles in order to justify shooting at the driver.
If you stand in front of a car and it's driving at you, that constitutes deadly force, and then they can shoot back.
That's the justification, yes.
Now, why did CBP commission this survey to begin with? Do you know?
We have to go back to 2012 to understand that. There were two shooting incidents on the border that got a lot of media attention and also the attention of the Mexican government.
What was special about these cases?
In September 2012, a man about 36 years old was having a picnic on the Rio Grande, and he was shot and killed when a Border Patrol agent in a boat opened fire on the banks, and the Border Patrol agent reported that he had been pelted with rocks. And the Mexican government was upset because this man apparently was just enjoying being outside with his family on the banks of the river. And then a month later, there was a 16-year-old boy who was on the Mexican side of the border fence in Nogales, Mexico, which is right across from Nogales, Arizona. And he was shot multiple times by a Border Patrol agent. Of the 10 shots that hit him, 8 of them came from behind and hit him in the back. In both of those cases, there's no indication that the people who were killed were armed. It was in response to that media outcry in late 2012 that Customs and Border Protection came forward and said, okay, we're going to do an internal review, and we're also going to commission this report from this outside group.
You said it was a damning report. It criticized the Border Patrol for lack of diligence in investigating these incidents. What was the response of CBP?
So this report was given to Customs and Border Protection in early 2013, and didn't see the light of day. I also was leaked an internal response to the recommendations, and the Border Patrol outright decided not to adopt those two recommendations that the Police Executive Research Forum had singled out as their most significant recommendations.
Which were?
One focused on the Border Patrol's policy towards shooting at people throwing rocks. What it said was that when people throw rocks at Border Patrol agents, Border Patrol agents should first try to find cover, and the Border Patrol had never expressly told its agents to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And the other recommendation was that when Border Patrol agents had a moving vehicle driving towards them, that they shouldn't shoot at the driver because then you have a disabled vehicle that is still careening out of control.
And then, just a week after your story ran, Customs and Border Protection released a 4-page memo to the public reversing its rejection, basically, of those recommendations.
And also they released the use of force handbook, which the agency had never publicly released before.
So is it because of Jay Johnson, the new head of DHS, that there is a move towards less opacity?
It's possible. It does look like he is trying to make some sort of shift in the culture there. Also, it's worth mentioning that Customs and Border Protection has a new commissioner, Gil Kerlikowske. He told senators during his confirmation hearing in January that he had never worked at a police department that did not release its use of force policies, and he intended, when he arrived at Customs and Border Protection, to be more transparent.
Do you think that these new guidelines will stick? That there'll be fewer of these deadly force incidents at the border? And do you think we'll ever know? The high-profile cases of officers standing in front of the cars or shooting across the border, can those people ever be investigated and maybe even prosecuted?
There are two tracks to an investigation after a shooting. One, there's a criminal track. These shootings are investigated by a local authority like the sheriff's office, or sometimes the FBI steps in. And those criminal investigations, they'll either be closed or they'll go to trial. And then there's another track, which is the administrative investigation inside the Border Patrol. And from the report that the law enforcement experts put together, after reviewing all of these cases, they came to the conclusion that there had been a lack of diligence on the Border Patrol's part in reviewing this.
Have any of these cases gone to trial?
None of the cases in the last 3 years have gone to trial.
None of those 67 cases?
Not as far as I know.
Mm-hmm. What is the next big piece of information you're looking for?
I really want to know how many people have been disciplined for exceeding the use of force policy. There have been a number of actions on the border that shock the conscience, frankly. And the big question is, has anyone been held account for that? And does the Border Patrol have the willingness to take action against agents that don't act in the best interest of the public? I also want to see what happens with these new use of force directives that the head of the Border Patrol released. So right now we have 4 pages of a directive that are really 4 pieces of paper. And the question is, will the directives trickle down into the workforce and really make a difference for the safety of the people living and operating around the border?
Brian, thank you very much.
Happy to be with you.
Brian Bennett is the national security correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune. The Freedom of Information Act, the means whereby U.S. citizens may petition the government for information, has been around since 1966. But according to the Center for Effective Government, federal agencies haven't quite yet mastered the art of disclosing. This week, the center released the first ever quantifiable measure of how 15 key government agencies process FOIA requests, called the Access to Information Scorecard 2014. It assessed the process, the rules, and the websites of the 15 most FOIA'd government agencies and assigned them a standard letter grade, like in school, on a scale of A to F. Sean Moulton is the director of open government policy at the Center for Effective Government and the co-author of the report. Sean, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you for having me.
If this is the first quantifiable look at the way the government processes FOIAs, what does that mean? What was done in the past?
The Department of Justice has been collecting information for years, but this is the first time anyone outside the government has really tried to score it over the entire realm of implementation, who's doing well and who's doing badly.
And you divide that realm basically into 3 areas. One is process. That's the fullness of the information provided and how long it takes. The second area is the rules for getting access. What's the agency policy on providing information? And the third area is simply how easy is the website to use?
Processing, even though it was only one of the 3 areas, was worth half of the overall grade, all by itself. Processing measures how well they're using their staff, how many resources they're dedicating to this, how well they're communicating with requesters, with other agencies. Rules and websites were considered each to be worth 25% of the overall grade.
The rules by which they would release information.
Yeah, their FOIA regulation.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not they had commitments to acknowledge requests as soon as they get them.
How across the board did the agencies do?
They struggled. They really did. 7 of those 15 agencies received a failing grade. Nobody got an A.
among the best. In what area did they do the best?
It really was a mix. The Social Security Administration, the top performer, they excelled in processing, by far. They did less well on their regulation and their website. Department of Justice, who came in second, reversed that. Their processing was mediocre. They got a D+, but they did extremely well on both their rules and their website. But I should note that they have a proposed rule they put out about a year ago that has some very troubling provisions in it. They would be able to lie to people about the existence of records in response to their requests.
They could say to a requester, that record doesn't exist?
Correct. Right now, most agencies will tell you if you ask for something around, let's say, an investigation, they'll say, we can't confirm or deny that record.
But actively lying about it will put an investigator off that trail entirely. And in
Correct.
Fact, on this show, we have talked about cases where the Department of Justice has been caught lying and has had to double back. So maybe it was just trying to legitimize a practice it was already following.
There is definitely a concern that that is what they're trying to do with this rule. But it's still a troubling practice and a practice we don't want to see other agencies start to adopt.
Hell no. And the Department of Justice got a B. Let's talk now about the absolute worst. These are the seven agencies that received an overall failing grade. The Departments of Labor, Veterans Affairs, Defense, Homeland Security, and State. The absolutely lowest scoring department was the Department of State. What made State so bad?
An absolutely abysmal processing score. They scored a 17% on processing. Without a doubt, they are slow. They do not disclose much.
Somewhere between Beijing and the Kremlin?
Something like that, I think.
All right, let's talk about Homeland Security. We basically hold it up as the exemplar of government opacity at its worst. Are we wrong?
They were tied for the second lowest score at an overall score of 51%. I mean, if it wasn't for State, they would have looked horrible.
So, Sean, I saw your list of recommendations. Establish effective disclosure rules, train personnel better, streamline workflow issues, create user-friendly interactive websites, doable things to strengthen the body that underpins FOIA. But the spirit still has to be willing. Unless the Department of Justice, the Department of State, the Department of Homeland Security are inclined to fulfill these requests, it doesn't matter how much they streamline their system.
You're talking about culture.
Yeah.
There's no easy recommendation on how do you change culture. What we're trying to do is, little by little, chip away at that culture to create new habits. The hope is that as we continue to raise the bar and get other things good about the rule and the website and how they process, the hope is that it continues to help nudge that culture in a different direction.
From the outside in, like they say, if you smile, eventually you'll get into a good mood.
Basically, yes, including the attitude of the government.
Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Sean Moulton is the Director of Open Government Policy at the Center for Effective Government.
This week, Twitter went dark for a half an hour, and predictably, a cyber freakout ensued. As Wired magazine put it, Twitter is no longer simply a place where people come to make jokes and drop quickie status updates. It's practically infrastructure, a core component of the global communication system. With more than 240 million active users engaged in activities ranging from abetting revolution to reporting tornadoes to photographing dessert, Twitter's cultural impact cannot be denied. But can we use it to chart how we actually communicate? Not just with our own cohorts, but with the world outside. The Pew Research Center set out to map the informational ecosystem of Twitter, and Lee Rainey, director of the Pew's Internet and American Life Project, says it is a social scientist's dream.
Think of this work as equivalent to 19th century biologists going up the Amazon or landing on a new island and literally being able to see things that had existed for a while but had never been seen and documented in this particular way.
By analyzing thousands of politically inclined conversations on Twitter, Pew created a series of maps with mountains, valleys, and islands distributed over six e-continents, each representing a different conversational structure. The first is familiar, a conversation prompting the emergence of two highly polarized crowds.
It really has the feel of sort of high school social structures where they don't talk to each other, but they definitely talk about each other.
Another map depicts a diffused crowd, like shoppers in a designer clothing store, all talking about the same brand, but not talking to each other. Pew found six structures in all. A third shows how news stories tend to prompt related niche conversations, like the spokes on a wheel. We'll let Rainey pick it up from there.
Another structure, we did a map of a very prominent commentator, Paul Krugman, that shows that every time he writes a column, there are lots of people who are paying attention and then talking about what he says, but they're not necessarily talking to each other about it. They're just passing it along to their tribes, to their followers. So it looks like a starburst. And the final one is the opposite of that, where people are working from the outside in to a centralized source. It's often the case that companies are now sort of following their brands and their reputations online, and they're trying to respond to customer commentary, sometimes customer complaints about what they're doing. So the spokes go in the opposite direction.
Oreos are so great with milk. Verizon really sucks.
That's pretty much the flavor of it.
We have often wrung our hands institutionally about the polarization of news and political thought and looked to social media like Twitter as a way to break down those barriers. So far, you're not seeing evidence that we are being more thoughtful, more open-minded, more Catholic in our tastes?
Certainly the maps that we produced for polarized conversations show what you've been worried about. There is very little interaction between the clusters. There's actually very little similar information. They literally are relying on different foundational information sources as the basis of their conversation. And one of the striking things that we see in American political discourse is that those in the liberal cluster are relying, in many cases, on traditional mainstream news sources. In the conservative cluster, there's sort of a parallel conservative media universe now that is becoming enormously potent in driving those conversations. However, researchers in Korea who have used this tool have seen a seventh kind of structure in conversations that looks more like a barbell. So there are definitely two big clusters of folks who are talking about their side of the story. But between the two big clusters, there actually is a pretty thick band of social network overlap, of information similarities. And so it might be the case that it's just certain issues in America do show this very deeply polarized echo chamber kind of structure. Other conversations in other kinds of locales don't have exactly that same worrisome polarization to it.
I guess what I'm asking you ultimately, Lee, is as you look at the data, do you find yourself welling up with tears of hope and inspiration or of, you know, despair?
Well, the researcher in me is crying for joy. We are able to look at dimensions of human behavior that were traditionally hard to explore, certainly hard to give contours to in maps like this. Think of us as being astronomers who have gotten a much more powerful telescope to look deeper into the heavens. We're just happy to see this stuff. So this is the beginning of a general exploration of human relations that we haven't had before.
That's the scientist in you. Tell me about the citizen in you.
It cuts in both directions. There are things that do make you feel like new kinds of connections are being built, new kinds of relationships are being nurtured. However, you can see lots of the ways that people are miserable to each other. It's not a uniformly good or uniformly bad story, but from a research perspective, knowing all of that is an enormous advantage.
Well, that's reasonably optimistic. I'll tell you what, if with your permission, you cling to that and I'll go for the despair. Lee, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob.
Lee Rainey is co-author of the report Mapping Twitter Topic Networks, and he's director of Pew's Internet and American Life Project. The segment you're about to hear contains fleeting references to disturbing topics such as ageism, rape, homophobia, mental illness, and colonialism. If the acknowledgement of the existence of any of these issues upsets you, please turn down your radio. Okay? Consider that your trigger warning. Trigger warnings have been around on the internet for years, but recently they exploded onto such venues as the Huffington Post, the BBC, and yes, even NPR. Recently, a group of students at the University of California, Santa Barbara, passed a resolution imploring administrators to include mandatory trigger warnings in potentially offensive syllabi. It seems that increasingly what started as a courtesy to readers is morphing into compulsory emotional correctness. Jenny Jarvie has recently written on the subject in The New Republic. She says she became interested when someone in an online forum said that any mention of pregnancy should be accompanied with a trigger warning to protect infertile women who may be offended by such a topic.
After that, it wasn't just that people put warnings on posts about pregnancy, but actually women seemed to avoid the subject of births and babies altogether after that. The request for warnings changed the course of discussion.
Tell me the history of the trigger warning.
It began in the 1990s on internet self-help forums to help readers who might suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder to avoid graphic content that might cause painful memories or panic attacks. But it's definitely starting to play a growing role in public conversation. You know, we have alerts being placed on more material, from statistics about hate crimes to novels such as The Great Gatsby. So what began as a way of moderating internet forums for the vulnerable and mentally ill seems to be becoming a regular part of mainstream public discussion.
On the radio, long before the 90s, we took care to warn people so that they could not only take care of their own sensibilities, but their children's, who might be in the room. But in this case, the whole notion has mutated. How so?
What really grabbed me was their use in the academic setting. Students are demanding trigger warnings on class content, and many lecturers are actually starting to oblige by issuing alerts on class syllabi and before presentations, even emailing notes ahead of class to warn students. To give an example, one student at Rutgers has argued that F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby, which is a book that many 11th graders across America read, should have a trigger warning for suicide, domestic abuse, and graphic violence. At Oberlin College, lecturers are told to be aware of racism, classism, sexism, heterosexism, cissexism, ableism, and other issues of privilege and oppression. Officials there cite Chinua Achebe's novel, Things Fall Apart, should carry a warning because it's about colonialism and religious persecution. And I think in this context, it's really hard to think of a book that wouldn't carry a trigger warning.
At least one worth reading.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I was thinking, well, what did I read in college? You know, and Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, Toni Morrison's Beloved. I mean, I can't think of a book that couldn't potentially contain disturbing ideas or make someone uncomfortable. And, you know, and that's the thing. It's exploring the world of literature or ideas involves grappling with difficult subjects. That's a given. And, you know, I think that slapping warnings on such a wide range of books reinforces the idea that words harm. And that undermines the principle of intellectual exploration. You know, if you think of the word trigger, it's understanding words as a device that activates a mechanism or causes an effect. And I think that encourages a very rigid approach to language. In my mind, there's no rational basis for applying trigger warnings because there's no objective measure of words' potential harm. Of course, words are really powerful, and they can inspire very intense reactions, but we react to these words in different ways.
Speech and journalism and art, not only are they at risk of triggering emotional reactions, they're intended to create emotional reactions. That's what they're for, are they not?
Yeah, when I went to college, I wanted to grapple with difficult subjects. And I think it's worth asking, why are we putting more warnings on words? Is it because words are more dangerous today? Is it because people today have endured more trauma? I'm skeptical of the idea that more students at Oberlin College are suffering more from colonialism and violence. And I think it really makes more sense to understand trigger warning as part of a growing ritual of offense-taking. And the sad thing, I think, is that it doesn't really help us negotiate our reactions. It seems to exacerbate conflict and make our conversations more fraught.
I wonder if there is any research that suggests that trigger warnings are effective at what they're intending to do.
It is obviously a relatively new idea, but I haven't found any study that has shown it has. My sense is that by putting all the emphasis on individual feeling and sort of structuring public life around these fragile personal sensitivities, there's very little room for coming together to negotiate and work things out. trigger warnings are presented as a gesture of empathy and of compassion, but in fact, I think they lead only to greater solipsism. They encourage us to impose our personal feelings onto public discussion and claim offense when something disturbs us.
Jenny, I must ask you this. Do you have any kind of separation anxiety that bedevils you?
Not that I know of.
Okay, good, because I have to warn you, I'm about to say goodbye. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Jenny Jarvie is an Atlanta-based writer and reporter. Her article, Trigger Happy, appears on the New Republic's website.
Coming up, the 50th anniversary of a court case that ensures our right to criticize and accuse the government, even if sometimes we're wrong.
This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from GSK, whose Discovery Fast Track Challenge for Academics seeks to turn concepts into medicine at gsk.com/discoveryfasttrack. Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. 50 years ago this week, just months before the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Supreme Court rendered a decision in the case New York Times v. Sullivan that would forever alter the way journalists practice journalism. Though the First Amendment had already been around for nearly 200 years, it was narrowly focused. News outlets could be shuttered if sued by public figures over minor inaccuracies. The stakes were thus very high in New York Times v. Sullivan.
This was a story about the civil rights movement. It was a story about the New York Times covering the civil rights movement. And it was the story of local officials, in this case in Alabama, trying to use state libel laws to essentially chill the press.
Andrew Cohen is a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice and contributing editor at The Atlantic.
To force reporters either not to cover stories in the state or to cover civil rights stories in a way that was not true and more favorable to local officials than it was to the civil rights movement.
It begins, as you note in your piece, in March of 1960, and it wasn't about coverage. It was about a political ad that appeared in the New York Times broadly criticizing Southern officials for their aggressive response to civil rights protests.
Right. It's a full-page ad, which essentially decries the actions of local officials in Alabama. It was signed by Martin Luther King. It was signed by Harry Belafonte and other notable civil rights leaders. The New York Times accepted the ad, and it turned out that there were certain minor inaccuracies in the text of the full-page ad.
Like what?
Well, there was one sentence about the number of times that Martin Luther King had been arrested.
Uh-huh.
The figure was off by two. That's the kind of stuff that was cited by the public safety commissioner in Montgomery, Alabama, a man named Sullivan, who, although he was not identified in the ad, said that the Times had libeled him by publishing false material about him.
And the only protection against libel at the time was it had to be true. And in this case, because there were a couple of minor inaccuracies, the Times couldn't argue that.
That's exactly right. At the time, the First Amendment and libel laws were essentially separate. No court had really firmly linked the two in the context of public officials. So you had this First Amendment that says Congress shall make no law, abridging free speech and of the press. And then you had these libel laws, which were essentially doing just that.
How did Sullivan argue for defamation if he wasn't even mentioned?
So what he was able to do in Alabama, in the state courts, which of course were very favorable to him, is to say the mere mention of the police, the word police, linked him in the minds of readers. And that was one of the main contentions that the New York Times asserted as the case got to the U.S. Supreme Court, that creating a libel liability in the context where you don't identify the person specifically who is libeled would generally preclude any criticism of any government action anywhere by any person working within that government.
So the Alabama State Court decided in favor of Sullivan, and then the Alabama Supreme Court upheld the decision. Let me play you some C-SPAN tape from 1991 of the late, great Tony Lewis, who had covered the case for the Times.
Mr. Sullivan asked for $500,000 in damages, and a white jury, all-white jury, awarded him every penny of the $500,000. And others sued over the ad, including the governor of Alabama. Total sum demanded $3 million, and it was quite clear that if it were up to the Alabama juries, we'd be $3 million in the hole, the paper would. And the New York Times could not afford that kind of money then. It was a barely profitable newspaper.
It wasn't just intimidating to the New York Times. It was an offensive weapon, if you will, by Southern politicians and Southern officials to try to financially freeze out the reporting that was occurring in the South at that time. There had been circumstances where reporters were basically not sent on assignments in the South because of the fear of these sorts of libel lawsuits. Had this ruling stood, coverage of the civil rights movement going forward would have been far, far less aggressive. And of course, that may have made a difference in the way that public perceptions were altered as a result of that coverage.
So the Supreme Court took the case, heard arguments that you call more intense and passionate than most. We have some tape of Herbert Wexler, who was the lawyer on the side of the Times.
This action was judged in Alabama by an unconstitutional rule of law, a rule of law offensive to the First Amendment, an offensive on its face to the First Amendment. What it amounts to is that a public official is entitled to recover presumed and punitive damages subject to no legal limit and amount for the publication of a statement critical of his official action or even of the official action of an agency under his general supervision.
Now, arguing Sullivan's side of the case was M. Roland Nachman Jr., and he said that the precedent that would be set by letting the Times off would be far too dangerous.
We think that the defendant, in order to succeed, must convince this court that a newspaper corporation has an absolute immunity from anything it publishes, and we think that's something brand new in our jurisprudence. We think that it would have a devastating effect on this nation.
You know, what he was saying was, don't create this new rule. What the court did was to say, look, we are going to recognize a First Amendment protection here. Public officials aren't going to have the same protection under libel laws that private people would have. And that means we're going to allow the press to make mistakes. We're going to hold the press to certain standards, actual malice. So we're going to try to make it clear to news organizations that they have certain responsibilities to try to be accurate. But when there is a mistake, we're not necessarily going to jump to a huge punitive libel award.
Talk to me about the actual malice standard. How is it applied and how is it argued?
Yeah, well, that's a whole other conversation. The justices knew that they were extending First Amendment protections beyond where they had gone before. And so they wanted to do it in a way that they thought fairly balanced the interests of news organizations and First Amendment interests, but also to make sure that certain libel actions could succeed if there were particularly egregious factual mistakes or if there was some intentional libeling of a public official.
And so the attorneys on both sides found themselves arguing the issue of intention. Here's Wexler.
At the time when the publication was made, the New York Times had nothing by way of information to indicate that the statements were false.
And on the other side, Nachman, speaking for Sullivan.
We say that on the facts of this case, that there was the kind of recklessness and abandon and an inability to look at facts before publication, which could be the equivalent of intent.
This was a weak case on the facts for Alabama. And you wonder if history would be different, if the decision would be different, had the advertisement been incorrect in more material ways. You see in the argument made by the Alabama lawyer, talk about recklessness. This is an advertisement, right, signed by leading figures. The Times was essentially saying we had no duty to give it the kind of thorough fact-checking that we otherwise would and to require us to have a duty to do this and to get every single fact right in every single thing we print is simply something that the Constitution doesn't require. So you see in this exchange the recognition, I think, by Alabama that it wasn't going to win this case on the facts. It was going to win this case on the fact that the law had been a certain way for many, many decades and that it shouldn't change.
There was plenty of investigative reporting, before Times v. Sullivan and lots of criticism of the government. So why was this so crucial?
Talk about the criticism of the CIA and NSA and all of the major debates we have now. Those debates would be very different if the public officials involved in them felt that they could sue successfully under state law to prohibit people from criticizing them for one or two or three minor mistakes. You know, sometimes when you look at the context of New York Times versus Sullivan, you don't wonder about the ruling. You wonder why it took so long. 6 score, 7 score, 8 score years after the Bill of Rights is enacted, you have this very strong ruling that says, listen, there is a place in America for public dissent against public officials. They're not going to be able to use these libel and slander laws as offensive weapons to chill speech.
And yet, there are states that have passed food libel laws. So if you say something bad about a piece of steak, you can get sued.
Yeah, those laws do implicate the First Amendment in some respects. I think those laws are going to be challenged. I think the Supreme Court is very different today, obviously, in terms of its ideology than it was back in 1964. But Sullivan is still good law.
Andrew, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
Andrew Cohen is a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice, contributing editor at The Atlantic, and analyst for CBS Radio News.
Last Sunday, Cosmos, a space-time odyssey, debuted on Fox-affiliated networks. It is astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson's sequel to Carl Sagan's enormously popular Cosmos, A Personal Voyage, which first aired in 1980. In one episode of the original Cosmos, Sagan discusses the Golden Record, a disk attached to the Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 spacecrafts that contained information aliens would need to understand humanity. Here's Sagan reading the liner notes.
And on this record are a sampling of pictures, sounds, greetings, and an hour and a half of exquisite music, the Earth's greatest hits. A gift across the cosmic ocean from one island civilization to another. The record bears, in English, an additional little handwritten greeting. It says, to the makers of music, all worlds, all times.
Voyager 1 and its collection of tracks has left our solar system and is now drifting in the interstellar void. But before it left, as the New Yorker's Alex Ross found out, NASA made legal history of sorts when it became the first entity to claim the intergalactic right to use a piece of music. Alex, welcome to On the Media.
Hi, thanks. Good to be here.
When we think of sending musical signals to alien beings, here's what we might tend to think about. You recognize that from Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Somehow the extraterrestrials were grooving on that. Is this the real-life execution of that concept?
To some extent, I suppose. I mean, Sagan went about it a little differently. I don't think the idea was to communicate something in particular. I mean, the Close Encounters, it was the idea that sort of music could become this lingua franca through which, you know, civilizations could speak to one another. In this case, it's simply a kind of a message in a bottle. I think there is some melancholy subtext to this in that Sagan, from certain things that he said, was imagining a future day when human civilization will have come to an end, whether on Earth or having gone to other worlds, who knows, and that this possibly will be all that's left.
Now, that's the problem with messages in a bottle. There is only so much that you can stuff into it. And at least with technology back in the late 70s, they had to find just the right selection. Who's in the mixtape?
It goes from great classical composers, Bach and Beethoven and Stravinsky, to some pop music. There's Louis Armstrong, Blind Willie Johnson, Chuck Berry. They tried to get the Beatles, but there was some kind of rights problem with getting a Here Comes the Sun. And then there's a lot of world music, Senegalese percussion, Australian Aboriginal music, Azerbaijani bagpipes.
But even with the limited selection, they ran into copyright issues. You mentioned the Beatles, but there was another specific piece. Tell me about Laurie Spiegel.
She's a very important American electronic composer who's worked in many different media and was one of the first to really explore computer music. And so at the time, they essentially commissioned her to create this piece based on Johannes Kepler's theory that you could make music from plotting planetary orbits. You could translate them into sound. And so Spiegel, using the latest technology at that time in the late 70s, did translate the fluctuations of the orbits of the six planets known to Kepler at that time and created this very eerie piece where you hear these overlapping series of sliding tones. It does sound like something that really could be emanating from outer space. No one has really figured out yet what does it mean for something to be copyrighted outside of the particular national territories through which we define copyright now, and it's just kind of a subsection of this whole mysterious problem of how law is really going to work in space. So no one had really yet thought about these issues back in 1977, but nonetheless, NASA typed up this contract, which they sent to Laurie Spiegel, and it says, NASA shall have the right to use, reproduce, perform, sell, and distribute the work, or any portion thereof, in any and all media, without limitation, throughout the world, and extraterrestrially. And obviously, it's that final adverb there, which is the eyebrow raiser.
Although not the one that was a sticking point for Laurie Spiegel.
I know. Well, but she kind of thought, well, it's fine if they want to have the rights to this piece for all time in the infinity of outer space, but you know, I'd like to keep the rights here on Earth. And so she simply crossed out the phrase throughout the world and signed it and sent it back. And to the best of her recollection, there was actually no problem with that.
You know, probably a very prudent move on her part legally, because it's going to be a lot easier for her to collect damages from, let's say, the Walt Disney Company than it ever would have been for Planet K1631.
Right, yeah. And the discussion goes on, because actually after I published this piece, I heard from a German specialist in such matters, Sebastian Gola, who wrote to me saying that because there is no separate idea of copyright outside of terrestrial territories, by crossing out the terrestrial portion of the contract, Spiegel, I think, effectively reasserted her rights throughout the universe as well.
Now, in your piece, you make reference to another tickler situation. When a Canadian astronaut aboard the International Space Station grabbed his guitar and performed a David Bowie standard, Space Oddity.
This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade.
They actually jumped through all the hoops and got all the permissions in place before Chris Hadfield did that performance, which turned into a wildly popular YouTube video. But again, we don't really know the technicalities of it. I think it's rather debatable whether the copyright does still hold far out in space.
What was fascinating about that piece was not the extraterrestrial implications, but the terrestrial ones, because it turns out that on the space station, the various compartments are sort of like embassies. So the Japanese compartment is subject to Japanese property law, and the U.S. compartment is subject to U.S. property law, and so forth.
And there are serious issues that do arise in terms of the question of, well, if someone creates some amazing invention on the space station or on a future lunar colony, who does own the rights to it? And there is actually a Patents in Space Act, which was enacted in 1990, which was sort of trying to tie down the American part of this equation.
Now, you just wrote about this very recently in The New Yorker, but this golden record is something that started intriguing you like 30 years ago?
Yeah, well, you know, I was an astronomy kid, and when Cosmos came on the TV, I was 12 years old, and I was mesmerized by it. I watched every show. I watched the repeats. I got the Cosmos book. And then I got this book, Murmurs of Earth, which documents the golden record and how it was put together. And then, you know, at the same time, I was very deeply immersed in music and playing the piano and trying to write my own music and studying the history of music. And so there was this great convergence. And ever since then, every time some kind of news about the Voyagers appears in the paper, I'm just riveted. There's something also thrilling about the idea that this little vessel is still out there, transmitting faithfully, even with fading power. And even when the power finally dies, it will still be bearing this record.
Alex, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Alex Ross writes about music for The New Yorker. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Durkman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Mira Sharma, and Kimmy Regler. We had more help from Cameron Lindsay, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rick Kwan.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.